schematically motivated as follows. Suppose we study the scattering of an electron by an heavy proton. So we have some heavy proton, and we want to study how the electron passes by this heavy proton. So of course, when we have the electron approaching, it might exchange a photon, or it might exchange some further virtual processes with the proton. And we might just say, OK, here is the proton standing in flat space, and here comes the electron, and it exchanges all these virtual processes. And in this way, the first process, of course, the exchange of the photon just gives me the Coulomb potential. And then once we correct, I get this Welling potential, and I could, in principle, imagine correcting it further. Thus, I have an alternative description of an electron going by an heavy proton. Either I consider it as being a process where the heavy proton is in flat space and it just exchanges lots of virtual processes, and in this way the electron is scattered through the proton, or I just say, no, I have my electron, I forget about the proton, and I just say that it moves in a region where I have some non-trivial background. So I can either think in terms of a background where the electron moves, or I can think in terms of this Feynman diagram description. So something similar happens in string theory. So string theory is the theory of strings, both open like this loop here and both closed like this loop here and open like these ones here. By definition, open strings end on what are called brains. And so we have this theory where we have some open strings, some closed strings, which can split, and the closed strings can split into closed strings. The open strings can also emit some closed strings. And we have all these processes that we might imagine being able to draw. And here, for the non-specialists, let's just keep in mind that each of these strings is supposed to describe one particle in the low energy limit. And in particular, the open strings, the degrees of freedom which lives in these brains, in particular, they describe gluons, they describe particles, the usual particles of gauge theories. And these closed strings, which move here in the space-time, let's think of them as being the gravitons, which describe gravity. And then again, we have some dual description when we put some of these brains and we consider some closed string which passes by the brain, like before the electron was passing by the heavy proton. We can say that we have our closed string passing by the brain and interacting with it. It interacts once, it interacts twice, it interacts three times, and we could imagine this description in terms of the degrees of freedom of the brain. Or we could imagine resumming all these interactions with the brain and saying that instead the closed string moves in some non-trivial background, like the electron was moving in some non-trivial potential generated by the proton, and we could forget about the proton. So we have this dual description. Either we work with the degrees of freedom of the brain, which, as I told you, are these gauge theories described by gluons, or we work with a space-time picture where we have some gravity on a curved background. So an explicit example of this picture was put out by Maldacena in 97, which relates to very interesting theories. On the one hand, we have a supersymmetric four-dimensional conformal gauge theory, which is called n equals 4 super Young-Mills. And here is its Lagrangian. So you see the first part looks pretty much like QCD. Then we have some scalars, some fermions. And here is this toy model, this theory, which we can think of as a toy model for QCD. So here is a four-dimensional non-trivial gauge theory, which we might want to study. And this theory is dual to strings, which move in this background. As I told you, the brains, I can think of them as deforming some background where then the closed strings will move. And this background turns out to be ADS5 cross S5, which I represented schematically in this way. And I have then some two-dimensional field theory, of course, because my string, it has some sigma and some time. So by definition, string theory is a two-dimensional field theory. So we have here a four-dimensional non-trivial gauge theory dual to a two-dimensional field string theory, which describes strings in this space. And recently, there was last year a new duality of this kind between this time a three-dimensional gauge theory, which is a Chern-Simon theory with matter, and strings which move in a slightly different space, some ADS4 times CP3. So we have some concrete examples of dualities where we believe that we have this dual description between a system of gravity described by strings and the gauge theory. So in these dualities, in these nice dualities, the fields of my theory are some matrices, let's say some large matrices of size n. It's like a nanabelian gauge theory. And therefore, a very natural parameter to introduce is the Tuft coupling. So this theory is very naturally described in terms of the number of colors and the Tuft coupling lambda. And we will always consider the planar limits where n goes to infinity. So this is the well-known approximation where the n equals 3 in QCD is taken to be very large, which works very well, by the way. So let's consider only the planar limit. That's the first simplification that we are going to make. So here we are studying only planar graphs of my field theory. So I only have graphs where the lines do not cross. So I'm only studying here planar graphs such as this one. From the dual point of view, this toothed coupling is mapped to the radius of ADS. So I'm studying any toothed coupling, so it means that I'm studying strings in any ADS of any given size. In particular, I'm studying strings which move in a very small ADS. So these are very quantum strings because the size of the string is bigger than the size of ADS. So I can study very quantum strings, but I'm always in a planar limit, which means that this G string here is zero. And G string is the string coupling. It measures whether strings can split or not. So we have a theory of strings. They are very quantum in the sense that they oscillate a lot, but they don't split. So we don't have splitting of strings, which in this dual picture means we don't have non-planar graphs. These are what are called free strings. And notice something important through this identification of parameters in these dualities. When lambda is very large, when we are in a strongly coupled gauge theory regime, it maps to string theory in a very large, in an ADS space with very large radius, which are basically described by classical strings. And classical strings is something easy to describe. I just have some small string and I study its classical movement. But strongly coupled gauge theory, that's really something painful. On the other hand, perturbative gauge theory, doing some loop diagrams, one loop, two loops, three loops, I mean, three loops is already not easy, but okay, doing a couple of loops in gauge theory, is dual to highly quantum strings, to strings where this radius of ADS is very small. So this is, of course, something very powerful. And one of the ways we can use ADS-CFT, one of the ways we can look at these dualities, is by saying that they are a very powerful tool. They are a very powerful tool because they relate the hard regime of one theory to the easy regime of the other theory and vice versa. So they are quite powerful. On the other hand, there is an obvious drawback. It's hard to make comparisons. It's hard to say that this computation is really well done because I make some prediction for strong coupling, and then it's hard to check whether to compute it from the other side of the duality. Another very nice thing about ADS-CFT, which I'm not going to develop in this talk, is we can use it to define the string theory. Since this field theory is something very well defined, I have my field theory, it's just a non-abelian gauge theory, n equals 4, I can use it to define string theory, which is, of course, something much less well defined. But finally, for me, what I will use it for is as an inspiration. Let's try to use this ADS-CFT, the fact that we believe that the theories are mapped one to the other, as an inspiration. That is, by doing some easy computation here, we guess what the result should be. But then, at the end of the day, we should find the result by some honest means. So we are using it as an inspiration to try to guess what the answers are from each side of the correspondence. But at the end of the day, this should be not more than inspiration. We want to solve each theory independently. And here comes the obvious question. What do I mean by solving the theory? So this is a conformal field theory. So one satisfactory answer would be, well, you should be able to compute correlation functions. And since it's a conformal field theory, I need the two-point and the three-point functions. The two-point functions, if I pick two operators and I compute the two-point function, since it's a conformal field theory, I just have some power law decay. And what I want to know is what is the exponent in this power law? What are the anomalous dimensions, they are called, of these operators? So I want to know what is the scaling dimensions of the operators of my theory. From the ADS point of view, this is mapped. What are the string energies? What are the energies of the quantum strings? So these are the problem I want to address. A very interesting problem, which I will not comment until the end, concerns three-point couplings. And finally, another answer to what does it mean to solve a quantum field theory would be to compute exactly its S-matrix. And of course, in this room, there are many world specialists in the matter, and I'm not going into that direction. I'll just say that at the end, that integrability should also be related to scattering amplitudes, and this is something which I'm currently thinking of, even if I'm it here. So I said that this could be used as an inspiration to solve, but this might seem kind of hopeless, because as I told you, we are mapping an easy regime of one theory with a hard regime of the other theory. So basically, if we want to really compare, if we want to really solve, we will really have to solve, say, n equals 4 for any toothed coupling. And the only way we might expect to solve it is if some miracle happens. And this miracle is what happens here. It's integrability. So integrability, the techniques of integrability, which basically means exactly solvable models, appear in these non-trivial gauge theories. So how come? Integrability is something that we always expect for 1+1-dimensional theories. So this is what people in condensed matter know very well. Quantum spin chains, Hubbard model in one dimension. No, this is something very typical of 1+1 dimensions. So from the point of view of the string theory, this is not surprising. As I told you, string theory is a 2-dimensional field theory. We have some sigma, the world sheet in the world sheet, and some time. But from the point of view of the 4-dimensional gauge theory, it's not completely obvious what is the 1-dimensional object. In this case, what is the 1-dimensional spin chain? And the object is the most fundamental gauge invariant operator that you can construct in the field theory in large N, which is a trace of a product of fields at the same point. So since it is a trace of a product of fields, which are matrices, there is, of course, a one-dimension, this is a 1-dimensional object. So I might well think of this state as being some spin chain. I say that the scalar phi 1 is some blue ball, the scalar phi 2 is some red spin, 2 covariant derivatives, like some green spin with a 2 on top, and I have some spin chain which is mapped to an operator. So here is one dimension. Nothing special, this is only a question of notation. What about then anomalous dimensions? Well, computing the anomalous dimensions, it's an analog, it's equivalent to computing the mixing matrix in this theory. That is, I have many such spin chains, that is, such operators, which have the same classical dimension. But when I turn on quantum corrections, the degeneracy lifts, and I must mix the operators in order to get operators with a good anomalous dimension. And this is what we do when we renormalize the theory. So we have a quantum field theory, we need to renormalize it. And then we have this mixing matrix H, which mixes all these spin chains, which is an operator that I can compute in perturbation theory, whose eigenvalues are precisely the anomalous dimension, the spectrum of the theory that I want to compute. So notice that when I compute this matrix H, which mixes the spin chains among themselves, when I compute it in perturbation theory, since we are in the planar theory, what happens is that, you see, this H acts on spin chains and gives spin chains. So let's call it a spin chain Hamiltonian. This is what spin chain Hamiltonians do. They act on spin chains and they give spin chains. There is a very good reason for calling it the usual spin chain Hamiltonian, because since we are in the planar limit, at one loop order in perturbation theory, you see, only 2 neighboring guys can interact. Otherwise, for this one to interact with this one, the lines would have to cross the other line, so it would be outside the planar limit. So when we compute it in perturbation theory, this Hamiltonian is nearest neighbors, then next to nearest neighbors, then next to next to nearest neighbors. So it's exactly a physical Hamiltonian, which interacts nearest neighbors, and the order goes on as we increase the order. So far, this was only notation. And now comes the non-trivial statement, which was understood by Minahan and Zarembo in 2003, which was that this Hamiltonian, remarkably, turns out to be integrable. It turns out to be exactly the ones which we can borrow the techniques from condensed matter to solve. So these ones are exactly the Hamiltonians that we know how to solve. So this is very good. People could compute the first few orders in perturbation theory and understand that at each order, the Hamiltonian was integrable and they could use the techniques of condensed matter integrable models and of mathematical physics. However, this is not very illuminating. I mean, if you look at the Hamiltonian, the nearest neighbor Hamiltonian is just some permutator of spins. But if you go, say, to 4 loops, where the range is already slightly bigger, then it's already something like 1 page just to write down the Hamiltonian. So it starts to be messy and not very inspiring. And then a new quantity, a new idea came out, put forward by Matthias Staudacker, which was to replace this quantity Hamiltonian and think of one which is even better. And this is the 2-dimensional Magnan S matrix. So let me explain what that is. The idea is to consider operators, recall that each of these spins is one elementary field, which are now made of a large number of, say, blue scalars. So we have some large circle with a lot of fields. And then we have some fields which are not blue scalars, say some red scalar, some covariant derivative, some fermion. And we study these kind of fields with a large circle and then some excitations which move in this large circle. The blue fields we think of as vacuum and the other ones as particles, or borrowing the terminology from condensed matter, magnons. And then what is the natural object to study when we have this theory? Well, the natural object now is the scattering matrix between these magnons. Now the relevant question is, how does a red magnon scatter with a green magnon? How do these magnons in my spin chain scatter with one another? And this was an object, which was understood that this was the relevant object, this was an observation made by Staudacker. Suppose we want to compute it. I will explain in the next slide why it is really such a good quantity to compute, this 2x2S matrix. But let's for now suppose we want to compute it. What's the first thing to do? The third thing to do is understand what is the symmetry of the S matrix. That is, what is the symmetry which rotates my particles among themselves? What's the symmetry which rotates the red particle to the green particle to the pink particle? What's the symmetry which rotates the particles among themselves? Well, that's a subgroup of the full symmetry. And if you sort that out, that is PSU2/2 extended. Okay, the technical details of what is this supergroup is not important. But what's very relevant is that this subgroup of the full group, once we impose that the S matrix is invariant under this subgroup of the full group, it turns out that symmetry alone is enough to constrain completely the form of the S matrix. And this was the observation made by Bizet. So we have at hand the exact S matrix of magnons. So no, probably you are still thinking, why is this a relevant quantity? But I'm telling you that just based on symmetry, I could find the 2x2, the 2×2 exact S matrix based on symmetries.
What's the meaning of the momentum in the original and full theory?
So this momenta here, so you see, here I have a product of field, phi1, phi1, phi2. And then I just say that I make a Fourier transform. That is, I say that I make a linear combination where I have phi1, phi1, and phi2 at position 3. And I put here some at position n, and I put here e to the I p n, and I sum over n. So instead of considering a base of operators where the red spin is in position 1, 2, 3, 4, I consider a base where the red spin has some momenta p. Okay? No, this is just a Fourier transform of the position in the chain. So it is a one-dimensional momenta. There is nothing to do with a four-dimensional momenta.
Okay, so p is just a number between 0 and
2 pi. P is just a number between 0 and 2 pi, which describes how these magnons move in this fictitious spin chain, if you want. So, okay, we found it based on symmetry. And let me stress that this is not a weak coupling argument. This argument, since it relies only on symmetry, it is also true from the dual point of view. There, we also have a string, and these magnons here are mapped to excitations on the string. And it turns out, if you follow the dictionary, that the number of fields here, for example, L, is basically the size of the string. So when we consider a large number of fields, we are considering strings of a large size with some excitations moving in this large circle. And these symmetry arguments, they hold both at string and at gauge theory. So we have the exact S matrix at any coupling. And here, this is why this object is very important. And this is where integrability comes about, enters the game. So as you all know, in 1+1 dimension, if you scatter two particles in an elastic scattering, the final momenta must be equal to the original momenta, because total momenta and energy is conserved. And therefore, if you scatter two particles, you receive two particles with the same momenta, eventually interchanged. Now, if you scatter three particles, if you have some momenta p1, p2, and p3, you get some final set of momenta, which respects total momenta and energy conservation, but which a priori need not be the original set of momenta. It could have nothing to do. Unless you have some extra conserved charge, some unusual charge, which we will call higher charges, unless such charge Q3 exists, something like this, and then if this exists, indeed it implies that the original set of momenta is equal to the final set of momenta, just interchanged. So how to understand this physically? So what happens is the following. Suppose we prepare three wave packets in these theories where we have this extra charge Q3. And we prepare these three wave packets in quantum mechanics so that they will scatter at the same point. So we have these three wave packets prepared so that they will scatter in the same region of space-time. And now we can apply a symmetry of the theory to say that the amplitude for this process is the same as the amplitude for the process related to this one by a symmetry. This is what a symmetry means. If we apply this charge Q3, we see that its effect on a wave packet is the following. It shifts the wave packet, just like momentum and energy does. But it shifts the wave packet by a quantity which depends on the momenta of the wave packet. And therefore, what we get is that this process is equivalent to this process. That is, the three-body interaction factorizes in integrable theories into two-body interactions. And this explains why the original and final set of momenta are the same. Because a three-body scattering, I can think of it as a sequence of two-body scatterings. And in each of these scatterings, the momenta are at most interchanged. So this is something nice. In integrable theories, the scattering factorizes, and I only need to know the two-body S matrix. So OK, so this already explains a bit why I was interested in the two-body S matrix. But I can go even further. I can now put my integrable theory in a large circle, such as this one. And then I can try to understand, if I put some particles in this circle with some momenta for each of these particles, how could I compute the spectrum of the theory? How could I quantize the momenta of my particles in this circle? So what I do is the following. I pick one particle and carry it around the ring so that when it goes around the ring, it acquires a phase, which is a free propagation phase, plus the phase acquired due to the scattering with the other particles. And since the scattering factorizes, I can represent this phase as a product of two phases whenever it meets each of the other particles. And therefore, I get this system of equations, which are known as beta equations, which quantize the momenta of my integrable theory when I put it in some large circle. And this is important. The circle is large. We need this large L, because we need this picture of having enough space to having this particle scattering and this S matrix. We need to have these asymptotic regions where we can measure its energy. So this explains why to find the EDS-CFTS matrix was so important. Because now we have immediately the spectrum of all big operators of n equals 4 and of the dual string theory. Because now we know this S matrix, so we just solve these beta equations here. Notice that I put a hat because now particles have colors, so this S matrix is really a matrix, so this problem is slightly more complicated than the one in the previous slide. And if I solve this diagonalization problem, equals 0 here, then I quantize the momenta of my magnons in my spin chain, and I just sum over the dispersion relations of my magnon, like in a usual condensed matter system. And in this way, I obtain the exact spectrum of my theory, provided the size is big. And provided the size is big is what is represented by these three dots here. And I will be more rigorous about it in a few slides. So just so that you could see how explicit that is, let me flash you how these equations look like. So let me first say that this S matrix here, being a matrix, actually we don't have one bit equation, but rather a set of nested bit equations, because we have to introduce some variables which describe not only the scattering of the particles, but the scattering of the isotopic degrees of freedom of the particles also, like some spin waves on top of the particles. So the equations are a bit more complicated. So to write them, it's useful, instead of writing the momenta of the particles, to introduce some Joukowsky variables, x plus, x minus, x and u. They are called Joukowsky because you see that this map x plus 1 over x appears all over. And x plus 1 over x was the map introduced to Joukowsky to study hydrodynamics. It's the map which maps this circle here to this plane, this airplane wing. So it was introduced by Joukowsky to study this hydrodynamic problem. And it appears very often in this integrability in EDS-CFT problem. In terms of these variables, which parameterize the moment of my magnon, these are how the beta equations look like. So they are indeed kind of scary when one looks at it for the first time. There are not one type of momenta, as I told you. There are seven type of momenta, because basically the theory is very rich, and there are several isotopic degrees of freedom, several colors of the magnons. And you see each term here is a product up to a certain number of momenta, K3, for example, K5 here, for example. And when I specify how many particles of each type I want to plug into these equations and give to a computer so that he tells me where these positions are, when I specify how many of each one I want, I'm specifying which operators I want to study. So if I want to study some operators which only have some covariant derivatives and some scalars phi 1, then most of these equations I drop and the situation simplifies. But in general, these are how the equations look like. And here is an example of a solution where I pick some large operator with a large number of fields. So you might say, of course, these equations are kind of scary. But we should keep in mind that we are avoiding the computation of, say, 10 loop Feynman diagrams if the operator has some size like 11. So when we realize that we don't need to lose years computing these Feynman diagrams, then these equations are suddenly much nicer. So this equation really allows us to completely skip the computation of thousands and thousands of Feynman diagrams. And I will give you an idea of the magnitude of how many we'll have to compute if it was, for example, 4 loops in a minute. Well, but this is not the end of the story, because as I told you, all I've told you so far, which is, of course, very remarkable that people were able to write down some set of equations which give you the exact spectrum for any operator, provided it is large. It's still not the end of the story, because at the end of the day, we will want small operators. We will want the Konishi operator, some small operators of n equals 4 super young Mills. Finally, I will want some reasonable operator, some trace of phi I square, some trace of something reasonable, and not some trace of 1 million of fields. And for these operators, at some point, say, look at this operator here and think in terms of for loops. At for loops, you see, you have here a loop, here a gluon exchange, here another scalar interaction, here another gluon exchange. And at for loops, you see this spin here is already interacting with himself again. The range of the Hamiltonian was so big that it starts wrapping the spin chain. And at this order, the Bittansatz breaks down. We no longer have an asymptotic region, and the interaction can be no longer thought of as local. Now the interaction wraps, and these are the so-called wrapping interactions. So how can we go beyond wrapping interactions and study integrable field theories when I put them not in a large circle, but in a finite circle? Well, the idea to go around this limitation of large size was due to Matsubara and Zomolodchikov, and then refined by Dorian and Tateo. And the idea is the following. Suppose I want to compute, for example, the ground state energy of my theory in some finite length L, this E0 of L. Well, if the size of my theory is finite, if L is finite, this might seem like a hard question, because, I mean, the Bittansatz is not exact in this small L, in this size L here. So how would I compute it? I would put it in the path integral, fix the size to be L, and I want to pick out the ground state. So I would put it in a very small temperature. That is, I would compute the path integral in a huge time direction, which I would identify. That is, I would compute the path integral in a huge torus like this one, where here I would have my length, and here I would put a very big circle so that I would pick out only the ground state. This is how I would compute the ground state energy. And, I mean, from this point of view, this circle is small. Here, Bittansatz is approximate. But now I can say, let me think of it a bit differently. Let me think of what was previously time as being space. And now this time, which I took as huge to pick the ground state, is just a huge circle. But a huge circle is great. It's what I need to be able to use the Bittansatz techniques. So then, if I change, if I go to the cross channel, I have my theory in an asymptotically long circle, large circle, and then there is some finite periodic identification, that is, the theory is at some finite temperature, 1 over L. And then the path integral give me just Z is equal to exponential of minus the free energy, and here I wrote this small f, which is the free energy per unit length in this huge length R. And in this way, I realized that to compute the ground state energy of my theory, I can instead compute the free energy of my theory in some temperature 1 over L. And the key advantage of this is when I'm computing the free energy, I'm computing the free energy in the thermodynamic limit where the size is huge. So I can use the Bittansatz to compute the energy and to understand the entropy, and there the Bittansatz is exact. So from this, the other channel point of view. Now, there is a small, which is not so small, drawback, which is that this argument is valid for the ground state. But what we want to consider is some operator like the one in the previous picture, where I have two blue fields and two red fields. I want to consider some excitations on this vacuum. But for now, let's consider just the ground state. So before that, so let me just, I will just tell you what the result of this computation gives for the ADS-CFT, what the result of the computation of the free energy is. But let me explain you what are the steps involved in this computation. So you want to compute this free energy. So what do you do? First, you go to this channel where this radius is huge and where you can use Bitt equations. Since you are at some finite temperature, you are basically exciting everything. So all sorts of spins with all sorts of polarizations are being excited. So, and in a huge number because the temperature is finite. So the good way to describe it's not in terms of two or three momenta, but rather density of momenta. And densities, to work with these densities, I should make a catalog of all the bound states of Bitt equations, all the configurations of Bitt equations in the complex plane. And there are several of them. So there are some configurations of beta roots in the complex plane like this, which are these black ones. There are some configurations of beta roots which form some pyramids, which are very well known in condensed matter in the Hubbard model description. And we should understand all the bound states of the beta equations and write some density for each sort of bound state. These are the variables which enter my free energy, which I should minimize. So let me put each bound state of my theory in a point in this lattice here. So each point in this infinite T-shaped lattice is one of the bound states of my theory. What should I do next once I wrote my Bit equations in terms of these densities of all possible bound states? Well, since this radius is huge, I can compute the free energy by a saddle point. So I should minimize the free energy, and I obtain in this way some equations for these densities of bound states. So these densities of bound states, having represented them in the lattice, let me denote, say, this density of this kind of bound state by some y function with two indices, a and s, which tells me where is its position in the lattice. And then the equations which come out from the saddle point equation of the free energy are this set of functional equations here, where this plus and minus denote sheets by plus and minus I over 2. So this is the most technical slide. I just wanted to flash you to show you how explicit this construction is. So you see, you have some set of functional equations where a and s are give you the position in this lattice. Plus and minus are just some simple shifts by plus and minus I over 2. And if you solve these equations, you are obtaining the minimization, the saddle point equation for the free energy in this cross channel here. And then the free energy at the saddle point is given by the second term, without the first term, just the second term here. So the idea is that to compute the ground state energy, you solve this system of equations with appropriate boundary conditions, plug them into this integral, and you obtain the ground state energy of your integral theory. What about excited states? So here comes the dark magic trick of Dorian Tateo. So they say the following. If you have some integral theory at some finite size L, and you want to excite excited states, what you can do is pick L, which is some number like 5, and go to the complex plane with L. Make some loops in the complex plane, and when you come back to the same real value of L, you might have excited excited states. So the idea is that an analytic continuation in L to the complex plane might excite excited states, basically because the energy is a multi-covered surface, and when you go to the complex plane, sometimes you go through some cuts and you go through some sheet of excited states. But let's think of it, because for some models it is not more than this, I must say, like some trick, which we will try and then we will see if it works. So imagine I want to analytically continue this free energy here, which is this second integral. And this is the only technical point which I'm going to explain. So how to do it? Well, when I analytically continue, and I have this integral over the real axis, some singularities might approach this integral. When singularities approach a function, which approach the integrand, I must pick its singularities, and this is how I do this analytic continuation. So if I have some point where this 1 plus y is 0, this would be a singularity of this log, then I pick this singularity. It's a log pole, so it gives residue 1. And if I integrate by parts, I pick these extra terms here. But look, these extra terms, I should say that epsilon is the dispersion relation of the magnons. This sum of magnon dispersion relation is precisely what I expect for excited states. So indeed, this analytic continuation trick by picking extra singularities seems to revive suddenly excited states. So suddenly I have some term, which is some vacuum polarization, and then explicitly here, the excitations come out. And then the idea is, okay, we did some analytic continuation. This is some functional equation, so they don't change under analytic continuation. The only difference is that these equations have several solutions. Some of them give the ground state, and some of them give the excited state. The condition that we are studying excited states is given by this equation here. Y, a very simple equation, y equal to minus 1, which is the condition for the existence of a singularity. So this, if you want, you can call them exact bit equations compared to the previous equations, which were asymptotic bit equations. So you solve these exact bit equations, and you can obtain the spectrum of any operator at any value of the Tuft coupling. The Tuft coupling enters through the dispersion relation here and through the boundary conditions. So let me just give you an example. Suppose we want to compute the anomalous dimension of such operator. This is the simplest, the smallest, non-protected operator in the supersymmetric field theory. So you see from the spin chain point of view, we have two spin down, two spin up, minus the two neighboring spins are up, and the other two are down. So this is the simplest possible operator. And let's just solve our equation that we're coupling. And this is the result that we get. We get some 12 times g squared. And this is the order of perturbation theory growing. One loop, two loops, three loops, and four loops would be the interpretation in terms of Feynman diagrams. Well, the first three, one loop, two loops, and three loops, this is what we would get would we use the bit ansatz? This is not different from the result from the bit ansatz. But this one is, because this one at four loops, we start having these diagrams which wrap the operator where the bit ansatz is no longer valid. And if we were to try to reproduce this number here from a field theory computation, in component, it involves 130,000 diagrams. And this was done by Valajanin. So you compute this number, you compute this 130,000, and you get the same number as we got from the previous approach, which I was describing to you. And of course, I was being schematic, but I never spoke ever of Feynman diagrams. So it's really remarkable that this computation matches, and it's, of course, a very non-trivial check. I should say that the first people who observed this non-trivial check was Banyok and Yannick. And when they did compute this, they found this number, and here they found some, they found this number. But the explicit computation was already done, and the result was that these two numbers were okay, and this number here, it was different. And then in the day after, the group of Italians, Zanon and collaborators, issued a version 2 where they found a symmetry factor in one of the diagrams, and then the result turns out to be precisely as predicted. So, okay, so this is quite remarkable, and it is convincing that probably we are in the right track. We can compute some asymptotics that we're coupling, we could eventually expand that strong coupling, but actually we want to do more than this, and let me explain why do we have the reason to expect to be able to do more than this. And the reason is because this Y system equation, these functional equations, they are really remarkable. So first of all, they are equivalent under a change of variables to this set of equations here. There is one T missing here, which for most of you are equally good or equally bad, let's say, as the previous ones. But for many people, this Sirota equation rings a bell. So these Sirota equations are the most fundamental equation in integrable models, both in classical, where they give in many limits, Todd equations, Sein-Gordon equations, whatever you might imagine, and in the quantum level, where they describe quantum spin chain, quantum sigma models. These Sirota equations are really at the base of quantum and classical integrability. And it's already good that we were able to obtain some set of equations describing the spectrum. But it's really spectacular for us and really rewarding that the equations that we obtain are themselves integrable. They also can be thought as some integrable dynamics. So these equations here, like the original spin chain, like the classical sigma model, these equations are themselves also an integrable system. For example, these Sirota bilinear equations, they can be written as the compatibility equation for a set of linear auxiliary problems. And this is how you say that the theory is integrable. Maybe a more explicit way to say why this Sirota equation is so remarkable, it's remarkable because it can solve it exactly. And we can solve it exactly exploiting some very nice identities using determinants. So let me tell you a very nice identity that most people don't know, which I find very beautiful. Suppose I pick one matrix and compute its determinant. This is this blue box. And suppose I compute the determinant of the same matrix where I remove the first line, the first column, and the last column. Here I am computing the determinant of the matrix where I excise the last column and the last row. Then this determinant holds. So notice that this relation between determinants is the analog of the 2x2 relation for the determinant of a matrix, where the determinant of a matrix is given by this one times this one minus this one times this one. But this relation here holds for matrices of any size. And it's not surprising, even though I'm not doing it explicit, if I say that this relation here can be mapped to this Sirota equation, which also contains 6 terms here. So exploiting these very nice relations using determinants, we can reduce the number, this infinite set of functional equations, to a finite set of equations. So, and this, for example, we did it recently. Recently, we studied the problem of a quantum particle in a 3-sphere, which is described by the SU2 principle chiral field. And there, we were indeed able to reduce an infinite set of Y system equations. There, the Y system are simpler. The lattice is not this T shape, but it's rather this simple line. We were able to reduce it using these identities with determinants to a single integral equation. It's called Destre de Vega for the specialists. And in this single Destre de Vega integral equation, we could solve it numerically. It was very easy to put it in a computer. Let me just flash you the code, for example, of Mathematica, which you can copy from our paper. So it's really complete. This is the code. You just select everything, you click Shift Enter in Mathematica, and you get a set of numbers which are the spectrum of the theory. So you see here, I'm specifying some quantum numbers, so 3 particles with all mode number 0. I'm saying that I put the theory with length 1/2. I just tell him to run, And I obtained this set of numbers after a few iterations. And you see that here it converged perfectly. These numbers are not changing anymore. And I put here a small circle. You see the zoom is 150%. So it's not even one page of code. So it's really something of simple implementation. So of course, now you can run this for several kind of operators and obtain a very nice spectrum of this very interesting interacting field theory for any possible size, to obtain the exact spectrum of all possible states and to do this, to find the spectrum of this integrable, strongly interacting two-dimensional field theory, which contains this plot enormously amount of physics. It contains a regime where it is described by Bittan-Zatz when the circle is very big. Then we start having corrections where we have virtual particles, these Luscher corrections, virtual particles which go around the world once. Then in the very extreme regime, which was very nice, we obtain the free conformal field theory where we have just three scalars on the top of the three sphere and where we see the central charge of the conformal field theory appearing and where we see then the perturbative quantum field theory where we see the beta function starting to appear and the, all these phenomena of an asymptotically free theory at this regime and of the infrared physics at the strong coupling. So, of course, given this plot, this is what we want to do now for ADS-CFT. Of course, we want to plot the operators for any coupling and to be able to explore all these windows of different physics to understand all these operators. So this is, of course, the next step. We would like to reduce now this set of functional equations to some very much simpler set of integral equations which we could eventually solve and obtain this plot. And this, I should say, it's not just a technical point. It certainly, I should not write might, it certainly contains new and very important physics. Because these Destre de Vega integral equations, they teach us normally about the quantum discretization of the models. Of course, there are some more explicit things we could do, like do Kohn-Ishiat five loops, compute some corrections. But I do think that the most interesting thing is to really have the spectrum at all values of lambda to be able to explore these several windows, these several regimes. So I could stop here, but I want to go a bit behind, I want to go back a bit to tell you about some interesting generalizations and some interesting directions. So far, as I tried to stress, there were two miracles which happened. On the one hand, the theory, this four-dimensional field theory, turned out to be integrable. And the dual theory turned out to be integrable. And therefore, we were able to write some exact equations to describe its spectrum. The second miracle was the equations themselves turned out to be integrable. Let me comment a bit on the first one. Why was n equals 4 integrable? And instead of answering why is n equals 4 integrable, let me tell you how this Q3, these extra charges which give this factorization of particles, how do they appear very naturally from the string theory point of view? So in string theory, and this is, there is a very beautiful mathematical construction of these higher charges. And it goes as follows. This is a two-dimensional field theory. And there exists a connection, a flat current, so it's flat, dA plus A wedge A is equal to zero. And what's remarkable is that this connection, which depends on the fields of my theory, it's flat for any value x, where x is a complex number that we introduce. So it depends on an arbitrary complex number, or for any x, it's conserved. It's flat. Why is this remarkable? Because then we can make this nice Wilson loop. So this Wilson loop goes around sigma, which parameterizes the string, in this world sheet cylinder. And the eigenvalues of this object, of this Wilson loop, which is called monodromy matrix, the eigenvalues don't depend on where I place this loop because this connection is flat. Well, but then this is a nice the eigenvalues are nice conserved charges. They are loops which don't depend on where I put it in the time. Well, but they are charges which depend on a generic complex number x. So they are automatically an infinite set of conserved charges because I can, for example, expand them at some x and each coefficient is a conserved charge. This is true in strings in ADS5 process 5. There the connection was understood by Ben Apolchinsky and Roivan, who built explicitly what is this flat current. The ADS4 CP3, this recent ABJM duality, is also integrable. And most sigma models, most simple sigma models, are classically integrable. So say the SON model, SUN model, all these models are integrable. So you see, this explains the existence of this extra, this huge amount of extra charges, which explain why the excitations in the world sheet factorize. And furthermore, notice that how do you compute these eigenvalues of the monodromy matrix? Well, you solve some characteristic equation. Since you solve some characteristic equation, by definition, your eigenvalues, they define some algebraic curve, some Riemann surface. When you solve some characteristic equation, you obtain lambda is equal to some square roots. So these eigenvalues, they describe some Riemann surface, by definition, because they are the solution to an algebra, to a determinant equation. And therefore, there is this nice map between classical string. You give me a classical string, I compute the eigenvalues of this object, and I get an algebraic curve. So it's useful to explore this nice map, because the next step we can do is to study, instead of studying classical strings, we can study quantum perturbations around these classical strings. And we can do it in this formalism of Riemann surfaces. This was something I did with Kolya Gromov. We can do it by mapping this, by doing the perturbations directly in the Riemann surfaces. We have some Riemann surface, which describes a classical motion, and we can perturb this Riemann surface to obtain immediately the quantum perturbations. And what do we learn? We learn that if we are given some Riemann surface, like a picture like this, we learn that actually these cuts of the Riemann surface are nothing but the condensation of a lot of beta roots of some quantum beta equations. So in this way, by studying the semi-classics, we can start seeing the structure of these cuts of the algebraic curve and see that, in fact, this red strip is nothing but a collection of a large number of quantum beta roots. And in this way, we can start seeing the quantum theory, and it can help us guess the quantum beta equations. So I would like to stress that in all this construction, there are mainly two weapons that we should keep in our pocket to use once we find an integrable theory. On the one hand, symmetry. As I told you, this 2/2 extended was highly constraining, and it allowed us to fix completely the S matrix of the magnons of the theory. On the other hand, we should exploit the classical integrability and understand its semi-classics to understand how the classical dynamics are discretized to start seeing this quantum dynamics. So let me just say that, for example, very recently, in the beginning, I told you that there was this other duality, this ABJM duality between this Chern-Simons theory and strings in ADS4. So very recently, Minahan and Zarembo, again, showed that the theory, the spin chain, is described by an integrable Hamiltonian. Again, this theory, if you compute the dilatation operator at leading order in perturbation theory, again, it's integrable. And then, it was some very exciting days. I remember I was writing my thesis. I stopped writing, and with Kolya Gromov, we did nothing but work on this. I remember it was 10 days after we proposed the whole loop asymptotic beta equations, which should describe the spectrum to all orders in the Tuft coupling, in this asymptotic notion where we need to have these big operators. And then recently with Volodya Kaldakov, when we, so this is how the equations look down, again, kind of scary, but they replace the computation of all possible Feynman diagrams. And more recently with Volodya Kaldakov, we wrote what is the exact planar spectrum, and again, it is described by some Y system, some set of functional equations, and the lattice where these functions live is now slightly different. Instead of being a T-shape, it's now given by this L-shaped hook with some bisection. All these shapes, all these domains where they live, they don't come from the sky. They have a very beautiful group theory interpretation, but of course I'm throwing it to the carpet. I'm not spending some time explaining it, but there is a beautiful mathematical structure behind it. So what should we learn about this? So we have some theories of quantum gravity and of gauge theories which are integrable. There are some theories for which we can compute the spectrum exactly. So what are those theories? I told you of two examples, this three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory, this n equals 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills theories. So there are a couple of features which are shared by these theories. They are superconformal gauge theories with gravity duals. And I have here several colors. Let me comment slightly on each of these words. So the theory was supersymmetric. This was important. Recall that it was important to have this group 2/2. And this slash means precisely that it's a quantum supergroup. It's not a quantum group, sorry, it's a supergroup. And it was important that it was a supergroup in order to have this 2/2 symmetry, which was very particular and very constraining. Actually, as you might have noticed, I said that the group is 2/2 extended. This extension comes about because actually the theory is a gauge theory. So the symmetries, you transform with 2/2 up to gauge transformations. And the gauge transformations give at the level of algebra work like a central extension. And if it was not extended, it will not be so restrictive. It's the fact that it's extended, that it's very restrictive, and which allows us to fix the S matrix for all values of the coupling. And this comes about because the theory was a gauge theory, and there was this gauge transformations extending the algebra. So this was quite important. Well, they were conformal field theory because we were computing their spectrum. We were computing the spectrum of the mixing matrix of these theories. And they were theories with simple gravitational duals related to Neil's question. So these theories, they have some simple gravitational duals. And therefore, it's not that easy to find two-dimensional theories which are integral classically. And then, since these theories are also supersymmetrics, it's also not very hard to at least believe that supersymmetry will preserve this integrability to the quantum level. And since when I go to the very quantum level, I land in my gauge theories, this might explain why these theories, why they had these gravity duals. It was by some reason. And of course, some very interesting questions emerge. So what is the landscape of these integrable theories? We found two. What is the general panorama? How close to QCD can we get? Can we find some integrable theories which are closer to QCD? Can we find some other dualities between gauge theories and theories of gravity based on the integrable structure that is flipping the logic around and trying to build the integrable structure and guessing which gauge theories could we be describing? And finally, another question, would be, what about going beyond the spectrum? So what I told you concerned computing the spectrum of the theory, the set of all anomalous dimensions or of all string states. Well, from what I've just described you of this idea that these charges are associated with some holonomies around this world sheet, the computation of other quantities such as three-point coupling, scattering amplitudes, and some other quantities you might imagine, it's very natural to expect integrability to play an important role. We also have a two-dimensional integrable theory governing all these processes. The topology is slightly different, but the structure is the same. And there are indeed some very recent interesting works which seem to point towards this conclusion, that indeed integrability might be useful way beyond the spectrum. So let me conclude. I tried to convey the idea that integrability provides us with a very elegant and unifying description of four-dimensional gauge theories or of higher dimensional gauge theories, in particular concerning the computation of their exact spectrum. And this is something very exciting. I mean, to obtain the spectrum of a four-dimensional gauge theory, this is the first known example where we have some equation which we believe that describe the spectrum of a gauge theory for all values of the toothed couple. Well, a very obvious next step, which we are working hardly to achieve, is to simplify this equation and to obtain a very nice picture with a spectrum, to obtain these curves. So this is a hard technical problem, a hard numerical problem, but also a hard conceptual problem, but a very interesting one. As I told you, a thorough classification of the integrable theories is still missing. We should understand what is the landscape of integrable theories, how close to QCD can we get. And we must be able to apply integrability techniques beyond the spectrum. And this is some direction which I'm eager to explore. Thank you very much.
Awesome paper will try to reproduce lack of entropies by counting how many walls you can write with the basic letter. If you have the exact spectrum, can you do an exact computation?
I think to study, I mean, there are some works by Polyakov on counting the number of words and relating it and trying to understand it. But I don't think that knowing the spectrum would help. I mean, and also this is a problem which already involves the deformation of the background. So it's not really within the planar spectrum, right?
Put it in the microcanonical standard and ask how many.
Yes.
Energy.
Yeah, we could. So this is, of course, an interesting question. So what we did was to compute the torus, a very thin torus, say, to compute the ground state. So what you are saying is, could we now compute the exact density of states of n equals 4 super Young Mills, right? So this is something very interesting, which we want to do. But first, we need to understand a couple of states. And then, in principle, we are able, indeed, to change from this microcanonical ensemble where we pick the state by state in our Y system equations. We might then work in some continuum limit of these Y system equations, trying to understand some density of states and how the solutions to this Y system are described in the thermodynamic limit. This would be a second interesting step, of course.
What's the relationship between these works and the one of Freddy, of computing the S-matrix with twisted theory?
That's a hard question. So there is a...
I was
going to
ask a question in the other direction.
So this is something that we are trying to understand, for example, in greater detail with Amit. I can tell that, for example, a very obvious connection, but maybe not so interesting, appears, for example, when you compute four-point amplitudes. Four-point amplitudes, they are governed by the so-called scaling function, which is the anomalous dimension of the lowest twist operators. So the operators with lots of covariant derivatives and two scalars. So these operators govern many scattering processes in real physics, the deep inelastic processes. They are governed by an exchange of these effective spins. So all this physics of these lowest twist operators, which are the operators which dominate the scattering amplitudes, the anomalous dimension of these operators appear directly in the form of the amplitudes, and they are related, for example, to BFKL approaches by Lipatov to the amplitudes and so on. Maybe a more, maybe a nicer answer for you is just to say that, you see, this will be some scattering amplitude process, right? So in principle, you could expect that if the theory contains all these higher charges, I might be able to use not only the conformal symmetry of my theory, but also the other charges of my theory to try to constrain the form of the scattering amplitude as much as possible. And this is something we are trying to do, trying to use all the charges of the integrable theory to try to constrain the form of the S-matrix, for example.
Looking
for some differential equation in the same way that you have some differential equation saying that the generator of some conformal transformation kills the amplitude, you will now have some extra, some supplementary, some further equations, hopefully, that could help you constrain completely the this process, this quantity. But I mean, this is one of the open directions, which is very exciting. That integrability lifts, yeah. I mean, at least from the point of view of this two-dimensional point of view, where the charges are described by some monodromy matrices, which contain some Yangian algebra, which are described by some Yangian algebra, this is very natural. And for example, it was checked recently by Drummond, Hand, and Plevka that indeed these higher integrability charges, that they kill the three-level scattering amplitudes. So how to lift it to all the all-loop scattering amplitudes, I think. That's the easiest way to state this very interesting question. Yeah?
I think my question is the second from a different point of view. Uh-huh. Four-dimensional Sutton-Einstein is an integrable system. It's related to a series of integrable systems.
Uh-huh.
Is there a way...
I don't know much about it. So is this related to these E8 and E9 groups or no?
No.
So it's an integrable theory?
With no supersymmetry.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So the question is, might it be possible to think the way you've been thinking and find a three-dimensional gauge theory that was due to it is also...
So my approach would be to start by studying the classical theory. Mm-hmm. So for example, in this other theory which appeared, this gravity in ADS4, what we did was we studied the classical solutions and we had some Riemann surfaces with, say, some seven sheets. So I would do the same in your case and write some algebraic finite gap method and to have this classical description in terms of Riemann surfaces. Then the most natural quantum discretization would be to say again that these cuts, which connect these branch cuts that connect the several sheets of the Riemann surface, would be the condensation of quantum beta roots. So in this way, I would guess the version of the quantum bit equations. Hopefully, I would be able to go all the way to weak coupling in these quantum bit equations, look at the equations and say, I'm describing some system with this and this symmetry, and maybe eventually guess the Lagrangian. Because the bit equations, as I stressed, all these Dynkin diagrams, all these regions, they encode a very precise group theoretical description. So when I would be looking at the bit equations, I would say this describes some symmetry with SO6 symmetry, etc. And maybe I would be able to do some progress. But I mean, I would have, as I told you, I don't even know very well what the model is. But yes. Yes. Reasonably well, at least, no?
No, it depends on the channel. If you take, say,
of course.
To the scale of channel, the mass of data front would be suppressed.
Okay. No, of course. Of course.
It's not even clear where it works with these keys.
Yes.
I'm horrified.
Yeah. I mean, QCD is not even conformal, right? So, but still, for example, some operators in QCD were shown to be described by a one-loop Hamiltonian, the integrable Hamiltonian. So there is some signs of simple integrability. And also there is this deep inelastic scattering in QCD, right? And there are many features which are very similar to N equals 4, right? In this BF, in this... No, not everything. But I mean, some important features like this deep inelastic scattering, etc., they do capture very nice features of QCD, I think.
That's where you get approximate conformal.
Yes, exactly.
So it's not surprising that that's kind
of course, of course.
That.
It's dominated by the gluons. The gluons are the same in N equals 4 or in QCD, of course. Thank you.